Hello, this is World Business Report from the BBC World Service, where we bring you the latest in money, marketing, manufacturing, and yes, much, much more. Please review us, rate us, share us wherever you can. BBC podcasts are supported by advertising.
I'm Katrina Perry from the Global Story podcast. Kamala Harris announces her running mate, Minnesota Governor Tim Walz. But do the vice presidential candidates really influence the election? And how will Tim Walz and J.D. Vance impact the final months of the race? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to the World Business Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Gideon Long, and on this edition, we're in Nigeria, where protests against the cost of living have been rumbling on for a week. Also, we ask, how close are we to seeing the first female billionaire athlete?
The female athletes who are coming as close to the men as possible are in tennis and athletics. Men and women have always played side by side. The women have had greater exposure. There's just more awareness of these female athletes.
And Elon Musk sues a range of companies, including Unilever and Mars, for colluding to refuse to advertise on his social media platform X. So what's he thinking?
I will say I make no efforts to understand what happens in Elon Musk's mind.
More of that later, but first, one of the world's largest mining companies, Glencore, says it shelved plans to spin off its coal-making arm. It had said it would list its coal business on the New York Stock Exchange, but after consulting its investors, it's changed its mind. So what is Glencore, and why does that decision matter? Here's a bit of background from our reporter, Izzy Greenfield.
If you've never heard of Glencore, it's one of the world's biggest commodities companies. It mines metals and coal and extracts oil and natural gas. Operating in more than 35 countries around the world, the firm employs more than 150,000 people. But mining for fossil fuels like coal has a big impact on the planet. Coal is the most polluting fuel of all. And like other energy companies, Glencore is under pressure to lower its emissions. It says it has the ambition to reach net zero by 2050 by shifting its focus towards the metals needed for greener technologies like electric cars and wind turbines. But last year, Glencore acquired four steelmaking coal mines in Canada from its rival, Teck, for just under $7 billion. The deal included plans to spin off that coal business into a separate company. Now, shareholders have rejected that plan, and critics say they want to see clear plans for how Glencore intends to reduce the emissions and wind them down over time.
What's known as ESG, or environmental and social governance, is supposed to be at the heart of investor decisions. So why did shareholders want to keep hold of the coal business? It's a major source of carbon emissions, of course, but it's also very profitable. So is this simply about making money, or is there more to it than that? I've been talking to Naomi Hogan from the Australasian Centre for Corporate Responsibility. It holds some shares in companies, including Glencore, and tries to use that leverage to get them to reduce their emissions.
It's interesting because there is an ESG argument for keeping the assets in Glencore. For a long time, investors have rightly been concerned about spinning out polluting assets and giving those or selling those assets off to other players that may not have the same governance or environmental considerations that the core company has. In this case, it's tricky because there have been concerns about Glencore's corporate governance and behaviour over a number of issues and over many years. However, there is an argument to say that keeping these assets in Glencore can allow for many investors who hold that stock, which is a diversified stock. It includes coal, but it also includes some of those green transition metals that are needed going forward, like copper, for example. And so there is an argument that while, yes, the coal assets provide some income and profits in the short term, it's more responsible that then the income from that goes into growing the transition metals business. And what we want to make sure and why we continue to focus on this area is to make sure that that does take place and that the coal assets do wind down in line with the Paris Agreement, and that we don't see Glencore spending more of shareholder capital on expanding coal. And that's the area where we have concern and have encouragement for the company to be more transparent about what its plans are for its coal assets and to make sure that they will wind down.
Right. But coal makes up around a third of Glencore's profit. So you can see it's a very important part of their business. And also, in justifying this move, Glencore says that it's used to make steel and there aren't that many alternatives if you want to make steel other than using coal.
And in the short term, that's true, but in the longer, mid to longer term, that is changing. Interestingly, we recently surveyed 500 investors globally and found that investors do foresee a transition away from metallurgical coal being needed in steelmaking because new technologies are coming online now that are able to shift how steel is made for a genuine green steel pathway that doesn't actually require metallurgical coal. So in the short term, that's very true. In the mid to long term, we are seeing changes, and that's where we think leadership and guidance is required from Glencore to demonstrate how it will face those changes, those significant transition risks going forward, and ensure that it's not exposed to major changes that then cause those what are now profitable assets to be very exposed to transition risk.
So, Naomi, what do you think the investors' motivation is? Why do you think they've pressured Glencore to make this decision?
I think this decision, on one hand, came from pressure from Gary Nagle, the CEO, who first proposed it. So for some investors, this isn't a new position for them. This has been their position all along. And I think there would be a wide variety of views. There is no doubt that in the short term, there is an argument for the profits that come along with these coal assets. And we know that there is also a really important segment of Glencore's investor base that is thinking about those longer-term climate risks and wanting to ensure that the company that they hold and they own has a clear view to how it will wind down these assets over time and wants Glencore to stick to its responsibility and its statement that it's made, that it will responsibly wind down these coal assets. And that's what we need to see more evidence around and get further clarity from the company on how it's now going to do that, now that it's made this decision to hold these assets into the future.
Naomi Hogan there from the Australasian Centre for Corporate Responsibility. And we did ask Glencore for an interview. It said no, but it sent us a statement in which it says it views steelmaking coal as important to help build the infrastructure needed for the energy transition. And it also said the decision not to spin off the coal business will help it fund its metals portfolio. Let's bring in Russ Mould, Investment Director at AJ Bell. Russ, thanks for being with us, as always. These ESG decisions are a real dilemma for companies, aren't they? Because on the one hand, firms, for the most part, want to do the right thing and be part of the green transition. On the other, they have to watch their bottom line and they have to please their investors.
Correct. And the share price is actually up 2% on the London Stock Exchange today, which probably tells you what investors think in the very, very short term. They probably like the bottom line angle, even though the company's coal profits fell very, very sharply in the first 6 months of the year. There's the issue of, yes, make money now, but the shareholders won't want them to get left with stranded, useless assets later. And they will want to see that money funneled away from coal into copper or nickel or other things that are used to help furnish the transition. And that's the issue. We know we want to go. It's how quickly we get there and what role Glencore can play in that transition.
Thanks, Russ. Stay with us. We've got a lot of corporate stories to talk about later. But first to Nigeria, where there have been serious protests against the cost of living this week. The government of Bola Tinubu has abolished fuel subsidies that many people relied on, and inflation is running at around 30%. But one thing that's really caught the eye in these protests this week is pictures and video footage of Russian flags among the crowds. Russia has been trying to gain more influence in Africa in recent years, investing in education, trade and military hardware. Baya Onanugu is a special advisor to the Nigerian president, and he spoke about this earlier to my colleague Rob Young.
The appearance of Russian flags on our streets was the handiwork of some people, some sinister people, who probably wanted to create some crisis in our country.
Okay, sinister people who are Nigerian or sinister people from elsewhere?
I think they are Nigerians. Yeah.
The Army Chief of Staff said that it was an act of treason, a capital offence to fly any foreign flag. To be clear, those people who have been arrested for flying the Russian flag, what is the maximum sentence they could face?
Well, treason in Nigeria is punishable by life imprisonment. The military authorities will continue to investigate and probably find out who sponsored them to do what they are doing.
OK, let's move on to the substantive issue about the protests then. Many people have been chanting, "We are hungry." There is a cost of living crisis in the country. Prices have been rising by 34% over the past year. Wages have gone up by nothing like that. Do you accept that people are hungry? They are facing hardship, largely because of the government's policies.
Nigeria is not the only country where people are going through a cost of living crisis. And this government has been very responsible in trying to resolve this problem. Even before the protests ever started, this government announced a series of measures to bring down the cost of food, especially. That's at the heart of the problem. And this government has been working vigorously since it came into office. And the indicators are showing that things are improving. The economy is improving.
Is the economy improving? I've been speaking to Dr. Muda Yusuf. He's the CEO of the Center for the Promotion of Private Enterprise in Lagos.
The main impact has been in the area of government revenue. Revenue to government has improved significantly, both to the federal government and to the subnationals. I think basically that has been the main positive effect of the reform. And this means that the governments now have more revenue to be able to spend. So that has been the major benefit from the reform.
Some improvements in the economy at a macroeconomic level, but clearly this isn't filtering down to ordinary people, and that's why they're on the streets.
Yes, that is exactly what has happened, because the social consequences or the social outcomes of the reforms has been in terms of very, very high inflation, high energy costs, and because of the devaluation that came with the reform, and because the country is highly import dependent, that has also triggered high cost of production, high cost of and high cost of imports. So there has been a lot of inflationary pressure driven by high energy costs and exchange rate devaluation. So whatever benefit has accrued was not enough, to mitigate, this high cost of living. That is what had led to the protest. Yeah.
And the inflation rate, as you say, is high. It's running at around 34% annually. But how much of this is to do with the cost of food specifically? Because food inflation is even higher than that.
Yes, food inflation is over 40%. So the bulk of the inflation is actually from food inflation. And that has been, driven largely by the devaluation of the currency and the insecurity that we are grappling with in Nigeria. Because many of the agricultural producing areas are grappling with problem of insecurity. Many of the farmers are not able to go to their farms. Quite a number of them are in IDP camps. So agricultural production has dropped significantly. So those two factors, insecurity and devaluation, has really fueled food inflation.
So high inflation, even higher food inflation. What about wages? Are they keeping up with these price rises?
No, certainly not. Certainly not. Because prices have gone between 50% to 100%. And wages are not moving in any commensurate way at all, except for a few private sector employers. For many other employers, they're not able to increase wages, to be able to match up with the rate of inflation.
Now, you had the Center for the Promotion of Private Enterprise. How difficult is it for small businesses to operate in the current climate?
No, it has been very difficult. It has been very difficult because their cost of operation, cost of production had gone up significantly, and they cannot pass on this cost to their consumers. So which means that they are the one bearing the burden of those costs, because consumer purchasing power is weak. The cost of energy has gone up significantly, which is making it difficult for some of them to operate. LSE's tariff has also gone up significantly. It is also making it even more difficult for them to operate. And cost of transportation is also a very big issue. So for many small businesses, that's an extremely very challenging.
And what more do you think the government could or should do to make life easier for people?
Well, the government is now trying to look in the direction of fiscal policy measures. So far, we have been, grappling with monetary policy, tightening interest rate and all of that. But that has not actually yielded much outcomes. So the government is now looking at fiscal policy, reducing import tariffs on food or raw materials on intermediate products for manufacturing companies. We are hoping that those fiscal policy measures around import duty and around issue of liberalizing trade is likely to bring some succor, to Nigerians.
Dr. Muda Yusuf there speaking to me from Lagos. You're with World Business Report from the BBC World Service. Now, US billionaire Elon Musk is suing a group of major companies, including Unilever and Mars, for colluding with each other not to advertise on his social media platform X. The lawsuit relates back to 2022, just after he bought X, which was then known as Twitter. Mr. Musk accuses the firms, alongside a trade association called the World Federation of Advertisers, of depriving X of billions of dollars in advertising revenue. I've been speaking to Christine Bartholomew, an expert on antitrust law at the University of Buffalo in New York. I put it to her that surely if companies don't want to advertise on X, they don't have to.
That's absolutely true. And the only question that comes up for antitrust is if the decision of where they advertise is made independently. Now, if advertisers unilaterally decide to not place an ad, no problem, no antitrust issue. The issue comes up if the advertisers agree amongst each other to not place advertisements on a particular platform.
So it's the collusion aspect of it that might cause problems.
Correct.
So does that mean that maybe the advertisers do have a case to answer here, that actually this might not be quite as clear cut as one would initially think?
Well, they're going to definitely have to respond to the complaint. But group boycott claims of this nature are not easy to prove. And so you have to actually, X is going to have to establish and prove up this agreement component. And that's not an easy hurdle.
Right. Now, this case started a couple of years ago. And the reason it started really is because advertising revenue on Twitter or X had collapsed at the time. That seems to be what's motivating Elon Musk in taking this action, right?
I will say I make no efforts to understand what happens in Elon Musk's mind. He's someone who definitely is motivated by his own views. But you're right on the rest of the content. The revenues had dropped and the timing that you describe is accurate.
Now, some of the advertisers said that they came off Twitter or they stopped advertising on Twitter because they didn't like a lot of the content and a lot of the political content that was on Twitter. If this is proved to be a politically motivated boycott, would that in itself be an antitrust violation?
Not necessarily. In the United States, there's a doctrine called the Norr-Pennington Doctrine, which protects certain types of speech that if otherwise would raise antitrust issues, Norr-Pennington can be a defense.
And how much of this do you think might be politics? I couldn't help noticing that X's lawyer in this case is a well-known right-wing figure, and the case itself has been filed in a Texas court with a conservative judge. I wonder how much this might be to do with politics rather than the law.
You do have to wonder that, because it's somewhat unusual for a company, for competitor lawsuits, for antitrust suits in the U.S. They exist, but from a just business practice standpoint, it's not done a ton because usually these competitors might someday want to work together. I don't really foresee a situation where these particular defendants would be looking forward to working with X in the future now that this lawsuit has been filed.
And finally, Christine, are there any other precedents? Are there any other cases like this that spring to mind in your experience as a lawyer?
It's interesting because group boycott cases, the quintessential successful one involved a company called Toys R Us. A group boycott claim was brought against them. But most of these group boycott cases are not particularly successful. It's hard to say without knowing what the evidence is, but it's going to turn on what proof, if any, X can present on this aspect of agreement. That's going to be crucial as well as proving up damages. Those are the two components of this complaint that would give me the most pause. Not only would they have to have proof at the requisite level that there was an actual agreement, not easy to prove under U.S. law, and they would have to prove up because X is seeking money damages, exactly how much each of these defendants supposedly opted to forego in placing ads on X. That's not easy to prove either.
Antitrust lawyer Christine Bartholomew there. We asked the World Federation of Advertisers to comment on this case, but they've told us they have nothing to say at this time. Russ Mould is still with us. Let's look at some of the other big financial stories making the news today. Russ, Novo Nordisk, we've seen so much positive news around this company recently, haven't we, with its weight loss and diabetes drugs, Ozempic and Wegovy, but the share price fell today after it issued its second quarter earnings.
Yes, it's still Europe's most profitable company by stock market valuation, but its shares are down 2.5%, as you say, on the Copenhagen Exchange. Very strong first half, profits and sales up by around a fifth, but they said that progress would be a bit more mixed in the second half of the year. That's largely because of what they politely called production bottlenecks, which I think is code for they can't keep up with demand. Now, that's a nice problem to have, but it does therefore cap upside to earnings estimates and greedy things that stock markets are. They like to see earnings forecasts going up. And it may also open up a window for competition to catch up. At the moment, there's really only Eli Lilly of America giving Novo Nordisk a run for its money here, but it may give others a chance to catch up there. And that's why, again, partly why the shares are down.
Yeah, and you do get the sense that they're facing an increasing competition from other pharmaceuticals, notably Eli Lilly, and Eli Lilly's results coming out tomorrow.
Yeah, and it's inevitable. If a company's making a huge amount of money, that's how capitalism should work. High returns on capital should attract more capital, and people will want a slice of the pie. And over time, therefore, actually, returns on capital will probably go down, but that's capitalism and it's most efficient.
Mm. And Disney, Inside Out 2, looks like being the highest grossing film of all time. Disney's announced its earnings today. How's it doing?
Well, the shares have wobbled a little bit. The numbers themselves were very good. As you mentioned, Inside Out 2 there and Deadpool and Wolverine have both done a great thing for their entertainment business, where the streaming business is also in a profit for the first time. But a small drop in profit at sports because the cost of showing Indian cricket's gone up, and a drop in profits experiences. Now, that's what's weighing on the share price. The company flagged good international demand for parks and cruises, but flagged weakness in America, which is very akin to what Airbnb said overnight about some signs that the American consumer is starting to show signs of stress, and that's what's weighing on the share price, because Disney admitted it could weigh not just on the next quarter, but the next two or three. And they said that, even though overall, the upgraded earnings forecast for the year.
Yeah, and Disney's also saying it's seeing that slowing consumer demand at its theme park specifically.
Yes, that's correct. And again, you know, from experience, I know they're not terribly cheap things. And it's intriguing to see that if you look at share prices like Airbnb, like Disney, or travel and leisure and consumer stocks in general in America, the index for those peaked in March or April this year, which is, again, interesting given that we've just really had the stock market in the last week or so start to get worried about whether there's real softness in the US economy or not.
Mm, and you mentioned Airbnb there, Russ. They issued their earnings last night. The share price dropped. This is to do, in part, with the protests that we've seen in places like Barcelona and Mallorca over tourism.
And Valencia. But I think they didn't actually mention that. They've particularly flagged America again as showing short lead times, weakening demand. That was the real reason they downgraded second half earnings forecast, and the shares are down 13% in New York.
Great, Russ. Thanks very much, as always, for joining us. Now, Simone Biles, Sha'Carri Richardson, and now Keely Hodgkinson, some of the biggest names in women's sports, are competing at the Olympics in Paris. But could any of them use their fame to become the first female billionaire athlete? Even if Serena Williams were to triple her wealth, she still wouldn't make it. Meanwhile, four male athletes have already reached that mark. My colleague Sam Fenwick sat down with women's sports writer Sue Anstis and began by asking why there's such a gap.
I just feel it's over such a long time that women haven't had that advantage, whether it's the profile, the exposure for those sports to, you know, is over 100 years worth that we're trying to make up from.
So if there is to be a first female billionaire athlete, where will she come from? Here's Jenny Mitten. She's the women's sports lead at marketing agency M&C Saatchi. She's worked on events like the Women's 2022 Euros, helping top brands like Barclays, O2 and BMW on their sponsorship efforts.
So at the moment, in these sort of lists, the female athletes who are coming as close to the men as possible are in tennis and athletics. And this is really simple. This is because in the tennis space and also in Olympics, men and women have always played side by side. The women have had greater exposure. There's just more awareness of these female athletes. So obviously you mentioned Serena Williams. She always comes top. Naomi Osaka as well. And then Simone Biles is in the US for athletics. But that's because for a long time, they've just had the exposure and the awareness.
So if that's where the top earners are going to be, let's look now in a bit more detail as to where they're investing their money. Four-time tennis Grand Slam winner Naomi Osaka made $55 million in 2020, a record for a female athlete, with only $5 million of that coming from prize money on the court. I sat down with her agent, Stuart Duguid. They set up an agency together to, in his words, build Naomi's business from a $50 million a year to $150 million a year. But since they launched, Naomi's taken a break break from the sport to become a mother. She returned to the courts in January following the birth of her first child after a year out.
I had a conversation this summer with, let's call it, one of the big three in tennis, his agent, his manager, who was saying, you know, his instruction from his client was, don't take any risks, which was, for the player, probably quite smart advice. The instruction I got from Naomi is, take risks, don't be afraid to mess a few things up, and if we can hit one or two sixes or home runs, then much better that than having never tried. Right now, for example, things we're looking at, so Naomi already has an investment in an NWSL team, which is a women's soccer, women's football team, the North Carolina Courage. We're looking at an investment in women's basketball right now. She has another investment in a startup league. It's called League One, which is a women's volleyball league. So if you take those three things together, we're saying this fits really nicely into a portfolio of someone that is very passionate about women's sports.
So do you think that there is more appetite from female athletes to invest their money back into female sport?
It does appear that that's the case. The more we hear of this, this kind of impact investment for a purposeful result. So it isn't just about making a return, as Naomi's agent said there. It is much more about the impact that it can have. And I think it's because they've experienced that themselves, of not having that growth and the inequality they've seen in their own sports.
If female athletes want to maximise their wealth and get to the billion-dollar mark, what barriers might be in their way? I spoke to Ricardo Fort. He is a sports marketing consultant and former head of sponsorship for Coca-Cola and Visa.
Depending on the country, women's sports are invisible. And it's really hard for an athlete, and it's really unfair with a female athlete, to expect that she can build a brand just pushing her own channels on social media. You need to get events broadcasted. It's very different from the men's side, because they know, everybody knows that the next NBA or Premier League or, you know, IPL game is going to be broadcasted in the US, England and India.
That's very difficult then for women to reach the billion-dollar mark. Do you think we'll get there?
I'm optimistic that this will happen in the next, 20 years. This is not going to happen overnight.
Sports sponsorship marketing expert Ricardo Fort ending that report from Sam Fenwick. You can hear more by searching for Sam's programme on Business Daily, wherever you get your BBC podcasts. Join us for our later editions. Roger Hearing will be in the presenter's chair then. But for now, that's all from me, Gideon Long, and this edition of World Business Report.
I'm Katrina Perry from the Global Story podcast. Kamala Harris announces her running mate, Minnesota Governor Tim Walz. But do the vice presidential candidates really influence the election? And how will Tim Walz and J.D. Vance impact the final months of the race? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.